From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Todd Solondz, screenwriter and director of the films Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness, and Storytelling, which is now out on VHS, soon out on DVD. He has a sense of humor that some viewers think is kind of sick and others think is very original and perceptive. Also, the life and music of Muddy Waters. We hear from Robert Gordon. His biography of the Delta blues singer and guitarist, Can't Be Satisfied, has just been published in paperback. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Hell's Highway, the new documentary about graphic driver's ed films in the 60s that warned kids of driving reckless or drunk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. CIA Director George Tenet said this afternoon that he wrongly let President Bush include a charge that Iraq had tried to buy uranium in Africa in his State of the Union address. NPR's Tom Gelton explains.
He said he was personally responsible for the approval process in the agency. He absolved President Bush of any responsibility for this error, saying in a statement that he released tonight, the president had every reason to believe the text presented to him was sound.
Tenet said the 16 words in question should never have been included in the text written for the president. There's been an increasing outcry over the statement and how it got into the address, with many in Congress calling for an investigation. Today, the U.S. reduced its troop presence in the Iraqi town of Fallujah. Troops left a police station and the mayor's office, though they remained in town. Local police had asked U.S. forces to leave, saying their presence was provoking violence. A U.S. military press officer said the American troops were not pulling out of Fallujah, but were trying to hand over more control to Iraqi police. The World Trade Organization has ruled that U.S. steel duties are illegal. The Bush administration initiated the temporary duties last year in an effort to protect the ailing domestic steel industry. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
President Bush introduced the emergency duties of up to 30% on imported steel products last March. The administration argued the tariffs were in keeping with a WTO provision that allows for temporary duties to protect a domestic product from a flood of cheap imports. Mr. Bush was also making good on a campaign promise to protect the steel industry. But the World Trade Organization has ruled that the steel tariffs violate global trading rules. The finding comes 5 months after an interim ruling that also went against the U.S. The European Union applauded the decision and is calling on the U.S. to remove its tariffs without delay. But the U.S. is expected to appeal the decision. If this happens, the WTO's appellate body will have 3 months to decide if the decision should stand. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Investigators studying the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster say they want to complete their report by late August. They say they'll provide a detailed analysis of this week's test in which a piece of foam fired at a wing segment punched a hole in the wing's insulating tile structure. The head of the panel, Harold Gaiman, says the group has already issued its toughest recommendation that NASA come up with a way for astronauts to repair holes while in orbit. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials closed up 83 points at 91.19 in active volume. That brought the Dow up 49 points for the week. The Nasdaq closed up 18 points to 17.33, the S&P 500 up 9 at 9.98. This is NPR News. Prosecutors in the case against Washington, D.C. area sniper suspect John Muhammad now support moving his murder trial out of the D.C. suburbs. Prosecutor Paul Ebert says the change is because of the trial for the other sniper suspect, John Lee Malvo, has been moved to Southeast Virginia, and it would be inconsistent to keep Muhammad's trial in the D.C. area. The judge in the Muhammad case still must rule on the motion to move the trial. The former superintendent of the Air Force Academy testified today before an independent panel that's examining the school's handling of sexual assault cases. Nancy Greenlease has the story.
During the PACT public hearing in Colorado Springs, Lieutenant General John Dallagher admitted that the leaders might have had a false sense of well-being. After all, he said the school's program for coping with sexual assault was considered an exemplary model. Dozens of female cadets have said that they suffered sexual assaults, and when they reported the incidents, faced punishment or mistreatment from superiors. Dallagher's testimony came a day after the Air Force demoted him. He will lose his star and rank upon retirement because the Air Force said he didn't exercise proper leadership. Dallagher is the first leader to receive individual blame for the scandal. No victim spoke, but a local Rape Crisis Center representative expressed her disgust at how the Academy graduated many cadets accused of crimes. The panel's report is expected in September. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Greenlace.
It's another shutdown scenario for Amtrak, according to the railroad. A House Appropriations Subcommittee approved a preliminary Amtrak budget of less than $600 million for 2004. Amtrak says that's less than a third of what the railroad needs to maintain its current level of service. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop features Jazz for Blue Nights and At Home in the World, the first two releases in the I Heard It on NPR CD series, online at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. You could say that screenwriter and director Todd Solondz has a strange sense of humor. He zeroes in on psychological kinks, malfunctions, and extremes, then exaggerates them. Some viewers found his 1998 movie Happiness in bad taste because the characters included a pedophile and someone obsessed with phone sex. But his fans and many movie critics thought he used these extremes to create a funny and perceptive take on the anxieties of modern life. His previous comedy, Welcome to the Dollhouse, was about the least popular girl in junior high. His latest film, Storytelling, is told in two separate parts. The first part begins with a college student, Marcus. He's an aspiring writer, but is very insecure about his work. He has cerebral palsy and has just written a short story based on his relationship with his girlfriend. He reads it in class and is critiqued first by his fellow students, then by his Pulitzer Prize-winning professor.
I thought that was really good, Marcus. Really moving and emotional.
Yeah, I thought it was really emotional, too.
And, I mean, really good word choices. It kind of reminded me a little of Faulkner, but East Coast and disabled.
Or Flannery O'Connor. She had multiple sclerosis.
And Borges, he was blind.
Updike has psoriasis.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm afraid I found the whole thing to be a little trite. Its earnestness is, it's a little embarrassing. And those adjectives are flat-footed and redundant. I'm sorry. What do I know? Don't even listen to what I say.
Anyone else? Catherine is right. The story's a piece of You express nothing but banalities, and, formally speaking, are unable to construct a single compelling sentence. You ride on a wave of cliches so worn, in fact, it actually approaches the level of grotesquerie. And your subtitle, The Rawness of Truth. Is this supposed to be a joke of some sort? Or are you just being pretentious?
A scene from the movie Storytelling, which is now out on video. The DVD will be released next week. When we first meet Marcus, he's passionately making love to his girlfriend. Only after do we find out he has cerebral palsy. Terry spoke with Todd Solondz last year and asked him about creating this character.
The last thing you want is to have a character defined by his affliction. If you don't have a cerebral palsy, then the natural response is to feel for this person. And yet, of course, this person doesn't want to be reduced to, of course, just someone with cerebral palsy. It cheats him of the right to be admired on the one hand for who he is as a person, or on the other hand, to be condemned for who he is as a person and should be, I think, respected or not on the same basis as everyone else.
In your movies, you've created a lot of characters who are very depressed, very alienated, also very self-delusional. In your movie, Welcome to the Dollhouse, the junior high school student at the center of the movie suffers every insult and indignity, from being taunted in the cafeteria to being threatened with rape at knife point. You grew up in suburban New Jersey. What were your school experiences like? Was that a difficult period for you going to school?
Well, it had its high points and its low points. I went to many different schools. I attended an Orthodox yeshiva. I attended a public school and attended also a progressive experimental school. And then I went to an all-boys prep school.
Wow, that's really so 360 degrees of schooling.
Yeah, so I kind of covered the gamut there. And I wanted, when I made Welcome to the Dollhouse, to make it a general public school, junior high school experience.
Now, you've taken the kind of alienation and discomfort that you write about and turned it into comedy, into a very kind of strange, eccentric form of comedy, but it's often comedy. And I'm wondering why comedy. And I ask that, I mean, for some people, comedy is just, it's where they live, you know what I mean? But it's not like you're being very funny or ironic in your approach to explaining things now. So does comedy feel like the natural place that you want to write in, or is it a more conscious thing that you're doing when you write comedy?
Well, I think my work is certainly reflective of how I see the world and how I experience it in some sense. What I find to be funny, I am often very moved by, and vice versa, that there is a connection between the two, and that if I'm not really moved, I probably won't find it very funny. My movies are comedies, emphatically comedies. They may be terribly sad and sorrowful and painful, but comedies, nevertheless. And this is, I think, what may not sit well with many people, that I, in fact, do look at them in this way. But without this level of detachment that the comedy or irony, what have you, provides, I think that the material would be unbearable. I don't know that I'd be able to sit through it otherwise.
You create characters who are often very disturbing, particularly in Happiness. You know, one character is a pedophile, one character is a phone sex, someone who calls up strangers to engage them in phone sex. Everybody in the movie is self-delusional about something. There's one of the sisters in the movie is a popular writer of transgressive S&M fiction. And she worries that she's not authentic because she writes about rape, but she's never been raped. And maybe if she was raped, then she could be authentic. So everybody's just a little bizarre in this. At the same time, I think you've written the characters with so much sympathy, even though they're very comedic, that it's almost as if you're playing out everybody's worst fear about themselves, kind of blowing out of proportion everybody's fears about their own fantasies or their own feelings that make them uncomfortable and have them embodied in these other characters.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. People look at my movies and will say to me, why do you make movies about such ugly characters? And I say, they're not ugly to me. The people may not be conventionally beautiful, so to speak, but it's not only in spite of their flaws, but in part because of their flaws that I can more fully embrace them as human. And it doesn't mean, for example, that you have to sympathize exactly with certainly what Bill Maplewood has done is unequivocally unforgivable. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
The pedophile character.
Yes, yes. Nevertheless, to be able to recognize him as human and not just the demon seed, I think accords oneself, I think, a greater level of humanity. And, of course, it's much easier if you want to create sympathetic characters. It's the easiest thing in the world. You know, you give them cancer, and, of course, your heart will go out to the person. But that's not a very challenging way of working, let's say, for me as a filmmaker. What I am most compelled by is getting into the minds into getting into subjects in ways that I think may force us to reevaluate our perceptions about not only other people, but ourselves.
Well, have you ever had people make assumptions about you that you found upsetting?
Let me say this. If someone doesn't like what I do, if they hate the movie, I don't have a problem with that. But occasionally there will be a journalist who will say something of a personal nature that, of course, I will take offense at. But most people are not like that. I remember back when Welcome to the Dollhouse was being received, often very favorably. Nevertheless, some journalists would describe Heather Matarazzo or myself physically in very unflattering terms. And I couldn't help wondering how that the irony seemed to elude these journalists, that they, in fact, became the seventh graders in that movie. To describe this 11-year-old girl as an ugly girl, I just can't understand how anyone would write that, and how one can possibly write that and feel good about oneself.
It sounds like when you were young, you weren't a very social person. You liked to stay home alone. And when you make movies, you kind of have to be a social person in a way, not necessarily going to parties, but being on the set with a lot of people, engaging with actors in a way that they're willing to still work with you. Do you think that you've been changed by the act of making movies?
It's true. I think that my character really isn't designed well for being a director on a set. I don't really enjoy the position. I don't get much pleasure out of all the power that I'm accorded. I get no adrenaline high from this. All I dream about while I'm on set is being back home again. It's an assaultive process, and one in which you simply don't have the absolute control, far from it, that you have as a writer when you're working alone in your room. Nevertheless, if someone's going to screw it up, I'd rather it be me than someone else. So I take on the job. On the other hand, I have to say, you know, it's part of the dilemma, part of the reality of being the filmmaker I am, at least, is that I find that when I am writing alone, my fantasy, of course, is being out there on set. Anything but being alone in this room.
I want to ask you about one scene in your new movie, Storytelling. There's a sex scene in which you obscure the sex act that's going on by just taking an orange rectangle and covering the actual coupling with the rectangle. Did you actually shoot the scene as a sex scene and then cover it up?
Here's what happened, and it's really it's more of a Soviet red, I believe, than an orange.
Okay.
In order to make this movie, I needed a certain amount of money that only New Line was going to provide. That's the studio that financed it finally. So it was either make the movie with New Line or not make it. I knew that New Line would not be able to release a movie that was not R-rated or PG-13. They will not release NC-17 movies. And I knew I had a scene in it that was a little bit troublesome. So I put in the contract and negotiated in the contract the ability to put beeps and or bars as necessary, as need be, in order to procure the R rating if there would be a problem. I've always felt good about this, that in any movie, that if there was going to be a problem with the ratings, I always wanted there to be, I'd rather there be a big red box covering something up, or a beep covering up a line, than to having something removed. So for me, this is very much a victory, to be able to put this red box over that shot rather than having the shot removed. I didn't want to have to redesign the movie to appease the needs of the ratings board. Of course, when the film was finished and we did have that big red box there, the head of the studio saw it and he said, "Over my dead body, you're not putting a big red box in this movie." But because I had negotiated at the get-go the ability to do that, the contract was respected. And this will be the first studio movie released with a big red box in the middle of it. I'm very proud. And I think that it actually adds a layer of meaning, I think, to the film. It does make it more overtly political in a way that I had never imagined it would be.
Well, Todd Solondz, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Screenwriter and director Todd Solondz speaking with Terry Gross. His film Storytelling is just out on video and comes out on DVD next week. Coming up, Hell's Highway. This is Fresh Air. A new documentary, Hell's Highway, tells the story of a company that made a series of driver's ed films in the 50s and 60s. They were movies that combined preachy and melodramatic narration with bloody footage of real dead bodies, and they scared the daylights out of millions of baby boomers. Critic David Edelstein has a review.
Sometimes it's not enough to face up to your nightmares. You have to figure out where they came from or who gave them to you. When I was in elementary school in the 60s, the wise elders screened a movie called The Child Molester, a supposed reenactment of the abduction and murder of two little girls. It ended with actual footage of their mutilated bodies. I got the message. I kept my distance from strangers in cars. 35 years later, though, I'm still haunted by that movie. And as a typically anxious parent, I think about how graphic I want my warnings to my own children to be. It's for their own good, right? It turns out that The Child Molester was made by the Highway Safety Foundation of Mansfield, Ohio, the same organization responsible for notorious driver's ed films with names like Wheels of Tragedy and Mechanized Death. They offered the usual stern warnings about the perils of driving recklessly or sleepily or drunk, except these films were capped with scenes shot by a shaky, handheld camera, moving in on flashing police lights in the night, then closer to smashed cars, then closer to shattered faces covered in glass and blood, and bodies twisted in unnatural positions. Sometimes you could hear the real moans and shrieks of the injured and dying. Once, the camera caught a man at the instant of death. Director Brett Wood attempts to tell the story of the Highway Safety Foundation in a documentary called Hell's Highway, The True Story of Highway Safety Films. He tracks down two of the surviving employees, Earl Deems and John Domer, and he mixes in original footage, including the finale of The Child Molester. Thanks, Brett. But to convey the monstrousness of these films, Wood obviously had to show something. And there are lessons to be learned, if not precisely the lessons these movies set out to teach. Here's some sample narration from one of them. It's just as well you can't see the footage of the dead young man in a black and white flannel shirt, half in and half out of his car.
A young man speeds home after enjoying a rollicking stag party. He thunders down a dirt road and plunges through a dead end, through a farmer's fence, and into an area that had recently been cleared of trees. With the man's body momentarily hanging outside, the car door hits a stump and forces the door against the driver's chest, crushing him between the door and the car's doorpost. Two ironies presented themselves in this case. One, the damage to the car was slight. A repair bill of $75 to $100 would have covered it easily. Second, the man and his wife were planning a party for the next day, a party observing his young son's birthday.
It sounds like kitsch today, but there's no dating the power of that image. Hell's Highway offers several points of view on the Highway Safety Foundation without really synthesizing them. The brilliant film historian and archivist Rick Prelinger explains that the educational movie genre was created in the 30s by insurance companies, hoping to shift blame for accidents from careless companies onto careless workers. The approach was adopted for World War II training movies and then mutated into a full-blown social guidance movement to teach teenagers in the 50s how to behave. But John Butler, an amazingly charismatic ex-cop who worked closely with the Highway Safety Foundation, sees its late founder, Richard Wayman, as a hero, a man responsible for saving who knows how many lives by scaring the bejesus out of kids. And then there's Mike Vraney, a guiding force at Something Weird Films, who simply marvels at the movies as camp artifacts that have retained their taboo fascination. It's too bad that the documentary isn't hip enough to invoke J.G. Ballard's novel Crash and contemplate the fetishistic side of the highway safety filmmakers who slept little and were obsessed with grabbing their cameras and heading to the side of the highway or to the morgue. Someone in the movie suggests that these films aren't as shocking now that we've had Sam Peckinpah and graphic video games and zombie cannibal movies. But to paraphrase Aristotle, we might get pleasure of a sort from seeing horrible images reproduced, even in minute detail, but not from viewing the thing itself. After seeing those little girls again, and the especially horrible shots of a dead baby under a car, I was upset for days. So I emphatically don't recommend Hell's Highway, unless you were exposed to these films as a child and hope for a kind of exorcism. The documentary isn't nearly as revelatory or as penetrating as it would need to be to overcome the exploitation factor. But my hope is that, as the shock of it recedes, Hell's Highway will help me to put my 35-year-old memory of the child molester into perspective and to grapple with a question I'm not even close to answering. When is the benefit of instilling caution worth the price of the nightmares?
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Hell's Highway opens in San Francisco next week and opens in other cities throughout the summer. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Easter Island, a novel about two women living 60 years apart by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Muddy Waters, the singer and musician who took blues in a new direction and also influenced rock and roll. A biography of Muddy Waters, Can't Be Satisfied, is now out in paperback. We talk with the author, Robert Gordon.
They call me Muddy Waters. I'm just restless man of the deep blue sea. Oh yeah, they call me Muddy Waters. I'm just restless man of the deep blue sea. You know I've been like that ever since my baby been gone for me. The night she left me, you know the rainbows were pouring down.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Robert Gordon's biography of blues guitarist and singer Muddy Waters is just out in paperback. Muddy Waters grew up on a plantation on the Mississippi Delta and moved to Chicago as a young man. He not only took the blues in a new direction, he influenced rock and roll. Gordon writes, his song Rolling Stone inspired a band name and a magazine. When Bob Dylan went from acoustic folk music to rock and roll, he hired white musicians who'd learned from Muddy in Chicago. Songs that Muddy wrote or made famous have become mainstream hits when performed by Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, and plenty of others. Robert Gordon is also the author of It Came from Memphis and The King on the Road. He directed the blues documentary All Day and All Night. Terry spoke with him last fall. Here's Muddy Waters, recorded in 1950.
Home in the morning, you don't come back. You don't come back until night. You won't cook me no food, and you still say you treat me right. But hey, you gonna need my help. I said. Well, you know I won't have to worry. I have everything, little girl, coming my way. No, I ain't gotta worry about it no more, man. All right, little Walker.
Robert Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with just summing up Muddy Waters' musical importance. Would you do that for us?
Okay. I think his great musical contribution is sort of juicing the blues and creating the foundation for rock and roll. He started in the Delta in the South on an acoustic guitar, and in the 40s went to Chicago where an acoustic guitar couldn't be heard in the clubs, and adapted the Delta blues style and the feeling of the Delta blues and put it first to an electric guitar and then into a full band. And when they started doing that faster in the 60s, they called it rock and roll.
You've put together some tracks that are well-known and some that are obscure. So let's listen to what is, I think, a pretty obscure Muddy Waters recording. This is from 1941. Before he started plugging in, and
right.
It's a well-known song of his, I Can't Be Satisfied. What should we be listening for in this 1941 recording?
Well, this is the first time he's going to hear himself back, which is an interesting thing to think about. He gets the validation from hearing this that he can do it. And what I think you hear in these early recordings, In his type of blues, you can hear the work. You can hear sort of, there's like blues like Robert Johnson where you hear kind of the field hand playing hooky. He's not at work. In Muddy, I think you hear the work. And so you can just kind of, I think this evokes the field very clearly.
So here's Muddy Waters, recorded in 1941, recorded by Alan Lomax.
I feel the day I'm gonna pack my suitcase and make my gear. But I'm troubled, I'm all right. And I never be satisfied, and I just can't keep up. Yeah, I know my little old bae, she gonna jump and shout. That old train be late, girl, and I come walking out. When I'm troubled, I'm all worried now. Yet I never be satisfied, and I just can't keep up. Yeah, I know somebody sure been talking to you. I don't need no telling, girl, I can watch the way you double. I'll be all right. Yet I never be satisfied, but I just can't keep up.
You describe what Muddy Waters' reaction was after Alan Lomax played back Waters' first recording. What was his reaction?
He hears himself, you know. He's got all these 78s in his cabin that he's heard, and when he hears himself back, he goes, "Man, I can sing."
So he was pleased with what he heard.
Yeah, he was pleased. I think he was astounded.
Robert Gordon, his biography of Muddy Waters, Can't Be Satisfied, is just out in paperback. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Gordon after a break. This is Fresh Air.
All right, little water.
Back now to our interview with Muddy Waters biographer, Robert Gordon.
Robert Gordon, let's jump ahead 7 years when he makes this song again and records it commercially. What's the difference between the two versions?
Essentially, what we're going to hear in this is what I call amplified Delta blues. That is, he's now been given an electric guitar and begun to figure it out. He hasn't created what will soon be called Chicago blues or urban blues or city blues. And instead here, it's the Delta style that we just heard with a little more power. I think you can feel the kind of tractor seat bounce in that song that we just heard and that we'll hear now. I just imagine him in a seat, either on a tractor or behind a plow, and I think there's the rhythm of those wheels and the furrowed field. I think all of that is right here.
Here's Muddy Waters in 1948. Can't Be Satisfied.
Child, don't you wanna go? Woman, I'm trouble. I be all good mine. Well, babe, I just can't be satisfied, and I just can't keep on. Well, I feel like snapping pistol in your face. I'm gonna let some graveyard lord be her resting. When I'm trouble, I be all wood mine. Well, baby, I can't never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on crying. Baby.
If I can I talk a little more about that song?
Can't Be Satisfied?
Yeah.
Sure.
Because that, when he makes that recording, on which basically his career is built, because Can't Be Satisfied comes out and it takes off. You know, he's established. It comes out on a Friday. It sells out over the weekend, which was very rare. And all of a sudden he's a name, you know, and then his career is going. That was recorded at his third session with Leonard Chess in Chicago. And at each session, it was Muddy Waters on guitar and a piano player. And you can hear where the guitar is about to break into modernity, and the piano gets in the way. You know, like, Leonard knew the old style. That was all he knew. And so when this third session is about to be done, Muddy speaks up and says, "Hold it. Let me do one my way." And because, you know, the results hadn't been great so far, Leonard says, "Okay." Muddy goes back out, no piano, you know, just him and a bass player now. And that's when he records this sound. And that is when Leonard's in the studio going, "What's he saying?" You know, he can't even get it. He can't get the sound or even understand it. And when there was a lady partner in the business at that time, Muddy always appealed to the ladies, and she got it. She said, "No, we got to put that out." And it gets, you know, leapt on right away by the Chicago people who thirsted for that sound.
Well, we've already heard that recording to which you just referred. Let's listen to another recording that Muddy Waters makes pretty early in his stay in Chicago. This is from 1950. And this is Rollin' and Tumblin', which has since been covered many times. What do you find remarkable about this recording?
Well, this is recorded upon their return to Chicago in 1950, after he's enjoyed some success. He and Jimmy Rogers, who was his guitarist, and Little Walter, who was the harmonica player, and Babyface Leroy on drums, they say, you know, "Man, we made it. Let's go home triumphant." And that's when they go back and do this tour in the South, and they get a program on KFFA where they'd heard King Biscuit Time, you know, in their youth. And they come back north, and Leonard Chess at Chess Records will not record the band. He's very, you know, he's got a successful thing. He didn't like to change. And Muddy was all about change. So the band went to this competing recording studio, and I think, and they laid down this track. And in it, I think you can hear, you know, the excitement of their triumphant return home, and they're back in the north, and, you know, the world is theirs, and they're just enjoying it. Very, very sexual, what we'll hear, too, which I think is, you know, at the core of the blues. You'll hear no words, essentially, here. This is just power.
Well, let's hear it. Recorded in 1950, Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters, recorded in 1950, Rollin' and Tumblin'. And my guest, Robert Gordon, is the author of a new biography of Muddy Waters called Can't Be Satisfied. Well, as you were explaining, Muddy Waters recorded that for a record label that wasn't Chess, because the Chess, Leonard Chess of Chess Records, didn't like the sound of it. But then Leonard Chess decides to record that song. What happened?
Chess was really the power in the market at the time, and that record came out. It didn't have Muddy's name on the label, but his sound was all over it. It was very clear who it was. It came out under the name of variously either Little Walter, the harmonica player, or Babyface Leroy, the drummer. And I love that drum in there. It's just like, you know, it's punk rock. 16th notes, just constant. And so Chess says, "Hey, you know, this is starting to take off. You come over here and do it for me." And they record a much cleaner version that doesn't have that same kind of frenzy to it. And it doesn't have the band either. But at that point, after that, Leonard Chess begins to bring in other bandmates, because the audience response to that version of Rollin' and Tumblin' indicated that the audience was ready for a band.
I'm going to skip ahead to 1951. to a recording called Still a Fool. And you say that this recording really exemplifies what's going to happen with the use of electric guitar. I talk a little bit about this 1951 recording and the new sound that Muddy Waters is getting in it.
This is the beginning of urban blues. This is the beginning. This is when the electric guitar is no longer playing amplified Delta blues. This is playing. This is a new sound. This is not a sound that they heard or could have made in the Delta. Listen to the power in the electric guitar. The crunch of the strings. Again, this is it's. I think it speaks for itself, really. But you'll hear, I mean, from here, this is where, this is essentially the foundation of modern blues.
Let's hear it. Muddy Waters, recorded in 1951, Still a Fool.
Well, that's two trains running.
Muddy Waters, recorded in 1951. My guest, Robert Gordon, is the author of a new biography of Muddy Waters called Can't Be Satisfied. That's a really pretty great recording. Do you think his singing changes as his guitar playing changes?
That's funny, because right in that song, I think you hear the guitar playing so entwined with the singing, and they both have that... it's almost like a distortion, you know, that rattle, that deep-chestedness. So I guess in a way it does. You know, the guitar sound essentially pulls him into this new kind of singing. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. But there, I think there it is, you know. That's where they're both entwined and they're both going. This is like new, and I just, I love hearing that song. I could hear that song all day.
Robert Gordon, from an interview recorded last fall with Terry Gross. His biography of Muddy Waters, Can't Be Satisfied, is now out in paperback. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue Terry's interview with writer Robert Gordon. His biography of Muddy Waters is called Can't Be Satisfied.
One of the things you did for the biography of Muddy Waters is find some of his surviving friends and surviving relatives Who are the surviving relatives that you were able to make contact with?
I made contact and became friends with Muddy's brother, his half-brother in Rolling Fork, Robert Morganfield, and his granddaughter, whom he raised, Amelia Cookie Cooper. And through them, really, once I met them and gained their trust and developed a rapport, I began to get beyond the stage and beyond the recording studio. It was easy to find bandmates, and they were happy to talk. But getting into the family, they took me inside the home. And Cookie, especially the granddaughter, she was raised by Muddy and his wife, lived with them since she was three in 1959. And I knocked on her door. She was expecting me. She opens the door and says, essentially, I told you I would talk to you, so come in, but I don't really want to talk to you. And I had waited about a year and a half or 2 years into my research to approach her because I wanted to go in educated and armed. And once I began to ask, you know, detailed family-specific questions, she opened up, and she said that Muddy, you know, was not a great man in the house, that, you know, she talked frankly about his womanizing and about the effect that had on his wife and in the household and on Cookie, and she laid it all on the line. She spoke very honestly, and that gave me, her doing that was a huge inspiration to me. Because it gave me, there is a dark side to Muddy Waters. In the foreword to the book, Keith Richards writes, there's a demon in all of us. And certainly there was a demon in Muddy. And her frank and forthright account of it allowed me to approach it similarly in the book.
Well, there's certainly a lot of darkness in his lyrics and a lot of sexuality in his lyrics. So I guess in that sense, it's not surprising that there was darkness and a lot of sexuality in his life as well. How did it affect your sense of him as a man to hear stories of his womanizing and of other things that he did that I imagine were dark or offensive to you?
I was on this book. It took me 5 years to write because it was, you know, because he didn't read or write. There was no filing cabinet I was going to find that had the box with his journal and all the answers in it, you know. So it took going around and finding the people. And in that 5 years, I went from, you know, really liking him to there was a period where I really didn't like him.
Did it affect your feelings about his music? Because let's face it, a lot of his songs are about having sex with women who you are not married to and who may be married to other people, or you may be married to another person.
She said, come on in now, Muddy. My husband just now left. That's from Rolling Stone. In the 5 years, I never tired of listening to the music. And I think what this sort of understanding of his... of his understanding of his sexuality, what that gave me was, I think, you know, I began to examine the lyrics deeper and kind of feel the sex in the songs deeper.
Why don't we close with a recording of Muddy Waters singing his song, Mannish Boy. What's the significance of this recording?
Well, you know, the sexuality here, again, is very clear. And several people in Muddy's family talked about that when he would sing this song, he brought a voice, you know, he threw his whole self into it, which I think was part of his art. You know, there's a lot of people who sound great, but he was able to make it work on tape time and time again. So I think what you hear here is Muddy Waters singing, you know, I'm a man, and he... When I asked Cookie, the granddaughter, once, you know, why do you think he did these bad things to the home? And she said, because he's a man. And, you know, that kind of left me stunned. But, you know, in this song, I think you'll hear it.
Robert Gordon's biography of Muddy Waters, Can't Be Satisfied, is just out in paperback.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything gonna be all right this morning. Oh, yeah. Greatest man alive. But now I'm a man, way past 21. I want you to leave me, baby. I have lots of fun. I'm a man. I spell him H-I.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
I'm a natural-born lover's man. Stone. I'm a man. I'm a hoochie coochie man. Sitting on the outside. Just me and my mate. You know I made the moon, honey. Come up 2 hours late. Wasn't that a man?
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, remembering Katharine Hepburn, we talk with award-winning biographer A. Scott Berg. He was a friend of Hepburn's for the last 20 years of her life. She agreed to let him write a book that would include the confidences she shared as long as he withheld publication until after her death. It's just been published. Join us for the next Fresh Air.